Ladies and gentlemen, the hearing is resumed. I noticed that we have another representative for Badgeworth Parish Council, and I just wondered, do you want to introduce yourself then, sir?
Sorry, yes, apologies for being late this morning. Slap hand. Richard Parker, Compton Bishop Parish
Council. Compton Bishop, thank you. Thank you. Right, we were on part five of the draft development consent order, powers of acquisition, and dealing with articles relating to the temporary use of land. I think my colleague has another question to put on that.
Mr. Humphreys, I've been searching for a definition of completion of the works as it is included in Article 30. I wonder, is there a definition? The purpose for my question relates to whether completion of the works includes the planting maintenance period, which you're currently proposing as 5 years, or whether it does not.
I don't think, subject to my being told I've got this completely wrong, but I don't think the Article 30 power was intended to extend to that sort of 5-year maintenance period. So the completion of the works would be when we had carried out the works to the line and done the planting. I think thereafter, insofar as planting may need maintenance, that's where we would then move to the maintenance power, sort of Article 32.
Thank you. So just one further question.
Yes.
Would you have anticipated then that embedded mitigation, i.e. the guaranteed mitigation, as
yes.
you describe it, that any of that would be planted onto land that falls under Article 30?
Some of it, I think, could be on Article 30 land. let me just explain, and forgive me for just taking a moment to sort of explain this. In essence, there are sort of three types, potentially, of planting. There's planting that will be on land that National Grid will compulsorily acquire, i.e. it will purchase the freehold interest in the land, substations and around substations, that type of planting. There's a second type of planting, which is where, because of the overhead line, and where it is, or a construction compound and where it is, it may be necessary to take down some existing trees. In relation to those existing trees, National Grid will replant or plant new trees by way of replacement, by way of mitigation for those lost, at more than one for one. I'll come back to that in a moment. The third type of planting, and that planting, sorry, is within the order limits, and we are taking power to do that planting. The third type of planting is obviously the off-site planting, which will be planting where we will make a financial contribution to others to undertake planting. That would have to be done with the consent of landowners, etc. Now, in relation to the middle category of planting.
Actually, I'll interrupt you because it's the first category that I'm interested in at the moment, and I'm sure we'll explore this in more detail next week.
Well, I was going to say the first category, of course, isn't under temporary possession anyway, because that category is where we are acquiring the land, and therefore it would be our land, it's our substation, our land. We would do landscape planting around our facilities as we do with many facilities. Because you asked the question in relation to temporary use, that's why I was explaining about the second category, which is where our overhead line is going along a certain route. There happens to be a tree in the line of that route. It's the farmer's tree and the farmer's land. We will plant more than one tree somewhere else as mitigation for the loss of that tree. It's not screen planting. It's not trying to screen. It's just replacing the tree. But that will then be on the farmer's land. It was the farmer's tree before. It will be the farmer's tree afterwards. We will not own or have any long-term rights to that tree other than the five-year period during which we are saying we will maintain that tree just to ensure that it has properly established. But it's the farmer's tree, assuming it's a farmer.
So where we have a situation that and I'm not thinking of the substation, I'm thinking of the ceiling end compound that is south of Puritan Ridge, where some of what is shown as mitigation planting on the mitigation plans in the environmental statement appear to be on land for which you are seeking temporary use. Would the maintenance of that still be achieved through the way we have the DCO written at present?
Madam, I think it's one of those things where someone may just have to produce a plan to show me to make sure that I'm correctly understanding. But if it's planting that is not on land that we are going to own in the long, you know, permanently, but which we are taking temporary possession and we are then carrying out planting, then its maintenance for the five-year period would be under Article 32. That's correct.
Thank you very much.
I think before we leave this section, the Joint Council, I believe, had proposed an amendment to requirement 34 in relation to the provision of pre-decommissioning surveys and post-decommissioning monitoring. And also a new requirement for decommissioning of existing infrastructure. Is that something that you're pursuing, Mr. Riley, in the light of the applicant's response?
In light of that response, I think we need to go back and reflect on that. But for now, I think we're maintaining what we've said to date.
Is there any other points anyone wants to make on part five, the powers of acquisition section? Right, we move on now to part six, miscellaneous and general. Mr. Riley, I believe that the Joint Councils had made a point in relation to Article 39.
Yes, thank you. Article 39, as it's drafted, refers to the defence against statutory nuisance. In Article 39, 1b, Roman 1, there's an ability for the defendant to show that the nuisance relates to premises. And the drafting carries on, premises being used in accordance with any scheme of monitoring and attenuation of noise agreed with the local authority. Now, the original model provision envisaged that that scheme, such a scheme, would be submitted as part of a requirement or in compliance with a requirement. There's no such requirement here. What we do have is a noise and vibration management plan, which I understand is intended by National Grid to be submitted as part of the CEMP and certified by the Secretary of State, if I've understood what I've read correctly. And it's making the link between this requirement, this article, and the relevant plan, which I imagine will be the NVMP, rather than another scheme, which there's no requirement to submit anywhere.
So what changes are you seeking, or is it just a matter that you're wanting to keep under review?
I think we want to keep it under review, but the article at the moment refers to a scheme which we don't expect to be submitted, and there's no requirement to submit it. As I understand it, the only relevant scheme at the moment is the NVMP.
Mr. Humphreys, have we got a degree of confusion here?
No confusion. Mr. Riley makes a perfectly fair and proper point, and the language of a monitoring attenuation scheme came from the model provision. Clearly that has been adapted. The language needs to be changed. Mr. Riley has very properly referred to the noise and vibration management plan. It may be that we refer to that or that we do this in some other way, but the essential point is absolutely correct. Mr. Riley's point is absolutely correct.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Now, the next article on the agenda is Article 40, which relates to temporary closure of and works in the River Avon. Certainly issues were raised by the Bristol Port Company initially in connection with this. Mr. Humphreys, I don't know if you can perhaps give a little explanation of the need for the scope of these powers that are sought.
Yes, madam. It's obviously important that we're able to undertake works in or over the River Avon, and for that purpose, and again for reasons of safety, it would be necessary to close the river for short periods. We gave an answer to one of your questions, question 10.14, in which we gave an indication of the periods, because although in some cases we've indicated, look, we may need to close during a certain phase for 2 to 4 days, it doesn't mean 2 to 4 days continuously, it means a number of single hours during the period of 2 to 4 days. We've obviously been seeking to discuss this with the port and the, I was going to say harbour master, I have a feeling his title might strictly be haven master. Yes, everyone's nodding, he is the haven master. Because it's obviously important that he is satisfied with the way in which this is this operates. We suspect that the way forward on this is for us to have a protective provision for the benefit of the haven master or some other contractual mechanism between us, which gives the haven master the comfort that the power is going to be operated in an appropriate in an appropriate way.
Certainly 42B gives you powers to close to navigation the relevant part of the river, and the grounds given are on the grounds of health and safety only. I mean, does that, for example, need to be more specifically defined or include a requirement to consult, for example, with the Bristol Port Company?
Well, I think that's the context within which we would envisage there either being a protective provision or an agreement. I mean, if together with the Haven Master we decide it's more appropriate to have something in the article itself, I'm sure that could be drafted. It's possible, however, that the provision may, there may be a number of sort of requirements as to what we have to do and who we have to notify and by when and what he has to do and so on, which may be just frankly slightly cumbersome to put in the article itself, and Schedule 15 therefore may be just a more elegant and neat way of doing it. The person who is primarily responsible here obviously for navigation is the Haven Master, and therefore it's for his protection that that would need to be done. But it is recognised that we would need to work with the Haven Master to make sure this is done in an appropriate way, and frankly we'd want to do that anyway.
So perhaps it's a matter I can have an update on at the Bristol Port Company issue specific hearing.
Yes, madam. Yeah. That sounds sensible.
Right, if we move on to Article 42, the question on the agenda was whether any cross-reference to the biodiversity mitigation strategy is required. That's the first point. Did you want to?
Perhaps I can elaborate a little bit. It was with particular reference to issues like the time at which trees and hedges can be lopped with regards to nesting birds, and that sort of information I think is found in the BMS.
Yes, madam. I think the biodiversity mitigation strategy is going to be part of the CEMP, and requirement 5.1 says that all construction works for the authorised development must be carried out in accordance with the CEMP. So, in a sense, in order to comply with requirement 5, we could only exercise that particular power, Article 42, in a way which was consistent with the biodiversity mitigation strategy. So, the scheme of the order generally is the articles are giving us various powers, and the requirements are setting constraints on those powers. I know some of the articles have constraints themselves, but I think the objective, which you are quite rightly pointing to, is already achieved, because as I've made clear, the construction works can only be carried out in accordance with the CEMP, and that includes, as an appendix, the mitigation, biodiversity mitigation strategy. So I hope that that it shouldn't actually be necessary to include that in Article 42.
Did you want to come back? No. The second part of the agenda point is looking at 42.1 and the reference to the felling or lopping of any tree or shrub near any part of the authorised development.
Madam, I think the point on this, I can completely understand the issue you're raising, and I think a word like near would be extremely difficult to define, but I think the real point here is when we read on and read the next line, because we can only fell or lop trees near any part of the authorised development if it, the undertaker, reasonably believes it be necessary to do so to prevent the tree or shrub obstructing or interfering with construction maintenance operation or constituting a danger. So in a sense, near is completely constrained by the definition of or the wording on whether or not tree obstructs or interferes or constitutes a danger, and that has to be a judgment. So it would be very difficult, for example, to say, look, 5 meters is near and beyond 5 meters is not near, because for a tree that was very, very tall, and if it was to fall into the line, that may constitute a danger or an interference with operation, out to a much greater distance. So I think this wording is sufficient, like this, if I may respectively suggest.
Right, the next article we were looking at is Article 43, trees subject to tree preservation orders.
Yes.
And the question put in the agenda is whether it is reasonable to include Article 43.2, which extends paragraph 1 to any other tree within the order limits subject to a tree preservation order, which was made before the order comes into force. Perhaps you could explain why you say...
Well,
right.
The point here is that the point is not really about whether or not it's within the order limits. It's in relation to a tree preservation order made before this order comes into force. In other words, we now know about tree preservation orders and those trees, and this gives us a consent to... fell or lop those trees despite the tree preservation order. What 43.2 was intended to do was to extend that to trees which may become subject to a TPO after this examination, i.e. they're not shown on any of the plans, but before the order comes into force. Actually, having considered it with the team, we think actually that it should be extended further. It should say before or after this order comes into force. In other words, we know now, and the authorities know and everyone else knows exactly what trees we're talking about. Just because a tree preservation order comes into effect at some time, whether before this order comes into force or after this order comes into force, we want the ability to fell or lop the tree, and we don't want mid-construction to find that another tree's been TPO'd and we have to stop construction and go off and get a tree preservation order consent. So we would suggest in the second line of Article 2, after the word before should be inserted or after.
Thank you. Sorry, Mr. Riley, was it in relation to Article 42 you wanted to make the point?
It was, yes. Yeah. Two points, really very similar to the ones that were made earlier. Mr. Humphreys explained how the biodiversity mitigation strategy related with Article 42 in his view. We had a very similar concern in relation to the tree and hedgerow protection strategy, which is brought forward by requirement 12. So a different requirement, but a similar strategy. And we were concerned that Article 42 should have regard to respect the tree and hedgerow protection strategy. I suspect Mr. Humphreys will say it's a very similar mechanism, but that was our first point. The second point was around the use of the word near, which we've discussed fairly extensively. And there was a concern on the joint council's part, in addition to what was discussed, that whether it could apply to plant or cranes, for example, coming down roads, whether it would allow National Grid to cut back trees overhanging roads, for example.
Mr. Humphreys, did you want to respond to those points?
Mr. Riley's right, as he anticipated. I mean, I think we would say the point he raises in relation to requirement 12 and tree protection plans falls into the same, and tree and hedgerow protection strategy falls into the same argument as the previous point, so I won't repeat that. In relation to the second point, I think it was a point being made about felling or lopping trees that might be on construction access routes. Madam, it's an interesting point that's raised. I don't think we had contemplated that the power went that far, because it relates to the felling or lopping of trees near any part of the authorised development. I think I would need to perhaps just discuss with the construction team whether there could be trees on the access routes or haul routes that we might need to fell or lop. I mean, obviously the point with all of this is simply to allow us to do things to construct the development, obviously. Can you just let me think about that, rather than giving you an instant answer? I'd just like
to make sure
that the construction team weren't counting on on being able to use this in that particular way.
Right, if we move on to Article 45, certification of plans. This has been touched on a little earlier in the day. The question posed is proposed arrangements for finalisation of the plans and whether there are any other plans, drawings or documents which should be included in this list, including the construction environmental management plan and the environmental statement.
Madam, we've got no difficulty with the CEMP or indeed the environmental statement being certified in this way, if that is thought appropriate. If we're going to certify the CEMP, then the definition of the CEMP will have to come out of Schedule 3 and it will have to go into Article 2, because the expression CEMP will have appeared in the main body of the order. Obviously, that's a consequential
that's a consequential amendment. As far as the ES is concerned, I'm just being passed a note on that. Madam, I don't know whether you picked any of that up. Apparently, I think there is some reluctance to certify the statement, the environmental statement, because it is a very large document. And because the mitigation is secured through the CEMP, which would be certified, or through other plans which are in requirement six, which are subject to approval, and therefore approval of the relevant planning authority, and therefore don't need certification because they're approved by the authority. We think that it's not necessary for the environmental statement to be, therefore to be certified. And certainly, as a generality, the Secretary of State has been very reluctant to have expressions in the equivalent of Article 45, such as any other plans or documents referred to in this order. And indeed, in the Thames Tideway Tunnel order, the Secretary of State took those words out as not being appropriate. So I think for the moment, we think the CEMP would go in to Article 45. The ES doesn't go in because the ES doesn't secure the mitigation, the requirements do. And of course, the CEMP would be defined as it is currently in Schedule 3 to include the various other plans that are appended to the CEMP to make it clear that those are also part of the document that's certified.
Just wondered, given that some of the earlier articles we were discussing did, for example, define the extent of the works by reference to the ES, whether it should in fact be certified so that everyone's perhaps clear and there is a certified document that says what that extent that has been assessed is.
Well, if you remember, Madam, the point I was making is that, and this was in relation to that much earlier point that we were talking about, that it's not the environmental statement that it was in the context of the word maintain that defines what the development is, and the word maintain is currently defined so as to be that list of words, but so as not to vary from the description of the authorised development in Schedule 1. Not the environmental statement, and that was the point we were making. The environmental statement is not what defines the development. That's the description in Schedule 1 of this order.
I'd like to briefly address that in relation to the tailpieces on the requirements, unless otherwise agreed with the relevant planning authority. This refers back to changes, I think, defined under requirement 1.3. Material new or materially different environmental effects from those assessed in the environmental statement. So it would seem to me that it would be useful to have the environmental statement certified so that we can have a route to track whether it's materially different from environmental effects.
But sir, if the environmental statement, as we were suggesting earlier, and which I accepted, is defined to say what it is, I'm just not sure why the Secretary of State certifying it makes any difference. It's quite a burden on the Secretary of State with such a document. If we define the Secretary of State as being that was submitted, plus, you know, this amendment and that amendment and so on, I'm not sure why what certifying it does.
Okay. I mean, I see that point. I'll just say that perhaps for clarity's sake, and also my previous experience is that environmental statement has been certified on a previous NSIP that I've dealt with.
Okay.
This same point was
made. In a sense, so from our perspective, I suppose it doesn't make an enormous amount of difference, and the Secretary of State can decide what he ultimately what he wants to do with it. He can certify it if he wants to, or he can not certify it. I think our view is that it's just not not necessarily but I don't think there's a lot of point us arguing about it at great length. The Secretary of State will do what the Secretary of State wants to do.
Yes, I think that's right, as long as it's presented as something which we would like him to decide upon. I think that's the...
Yes, I mean, as with the order in so many ways, you collectively as the examining authority write your report, you will make recommendations on things. The Secretary of State will pick those up, even on things that you haven't made a recommendation on, smaller drafting points. The Secretary of State very often just makes his own mind up and does as the Secretary of State thinks fit. So, as I say, I've expressed a view. It's not something that I think we feel very strongly about. Ultimately, we'll do what we're told.
Mr. Riley.
The Joint Councils have a concern that if the CEMP is certified, then it becomes part of the development consent order, and any flexibility to update it or revise it in the future becomes more limited. This is a scheme which, on the applicant's submission, may not start for another 8.5 years. And in that time, there may be needs, requirements to update the CEMP, which would be hard to do, even with a more moderate change procedure for development consent orders.
I think that comes on to an item later on dealing with the requirements, when we're asking how would the DCO secure and use the final version of the CEMP. And perhaps it's a good opportunity just for you to tell me how you're envisaging that would happen. How the CEMP, how the DCO would best secure the use of the final version of that document. Or is it something that you're seeing as ongoing?
Well, the Joint Council's preference, and again, I'll be stopped if I'm wrong, the Joint Council's preference has consistently been that they would like to have a final version of the CEMP submitted pursuant to a requirement for their approval before work begins.
And you would not like to see a version certified by the Secretary of State?
I think that would restrict flexibility on both the Joint Councils and perhaps, more importantly, for the applicant in the future.
All right, we'll may well come back to that in a moment. Is there anything that else that the applicant wants to say on Article 45?
Madam, not if we're coming back to it.
All right. Then moving on, Article 46, service of notices. The question was the definition of service by post. Really, it was just to find out how in practice this article was intended to operate.
Madam, yes, the expression by post is one that's very often used in legislation and has been for a number of years. The term by post is dealt with in the Interpretation Act 1978, Section 7. I'll read out what it says. It says, where an act authorises or requires any document to be served by post, whether by expression serve or expression give or send or any other expression used, then unless the contrary intention appears, the service is deemed to be effected by properly addressing, prepaying and posting a letter containing the document, unless the contrary is proven to have been effected at the time the letter would have been delivered in the ordinary course of the post. So I think that...
So you're saying that the Interpretation Act applies and that's acceptable and
yes,
can be readily understood?
Madam, I believe so. I mean, I understand entirely why you've asked the question, but it's... I think it's a term that's well understood, and the Interpretation Act assists on this.
Thank you. Right, if we move on now to Schedule 1, which we've touched on earlier, that is the authorised development. The first point, 6.1 on the agenda, is in relation to options A and B, and really it's to see whether any further changes to the draft DCO are required. Mr. Humphreys, I think you explained earlier in the day how it was intended to provide two separate draft DCOs, and that would presumably distinguish entirely between the two options. So,
Madam, the two I think a number of trees will have been sacrificed for this order. We will produce two versions of this thick document. The changes in them will relate to work 1F, where one of them will just have the option A work written in, and the other one will have the option B work written in, and work 4E and 4P, again, where one of them will have the option A work filled in and the other one the option B work. We had hoped that doing it so that you could just, I don't mean you, the Secretary of State could just decide which option A or B was preferred and then just strike the other one, as will have to be done throughout the order in a number of different respects where the Secretary of State, you know, wants to change things in accordance with your recommendations or his own views, was sufficient. But to because there has been some questions about this, we thought we would just produce two parallel ones, and that can be done for the relevant part of the book of reference as well. There will be an option A version of the book of reference and an option B version of the book of reference, and the Secretary of State will make whichever of the two alternative versions he thinks appropriate, if he thinks it's appropriate to make the order.
Right, well, thank you for explaining that. 6.2, this question is whether specific provision needs to be made to ensure that the 132 kV removal and undergrounding works take place in the event that the proposed new 400 kV line is constructed. I think this relates to some representations that have been made, people expressing concern that perhaps part of the development, if it were to be authorised, would take place and not other parts.
Madam, I think insofar as people have raised this, in a sense they're pushing at an open door. I mean, of course we would do it, but if it gives people comfort to have something written into the order, we can certainly do that.
I think that would certainly be the case.
Then it will be done.
The scope of associated developments set out in Schedule 1, we have considered that earlier in the day. I don't think there's any need. Right. Please go.
Sorry, madam. Just going back to the last the last discussion. I think in terms of adding some additional wording around the sort of taking down of what is in place currently, I think there's also an issue around timing of certain sections being taken down, which is a concern for Natural England, especially in the area south of Mark, where the assessment of potential impact on birds moving between the SBA Ramsar sites is based on, the assessment conclusions is based on the existing line coming down before the new line is in place. So if something covering timing could be included as well, that would be good.
Thank you for that point.
Yes, I'm just being told that we're aware of that issue and we're considering that. I can't really say anything more.
Right, thank you.
A small point to do with the content of Schedule 1 under work number 2C and work number 3A, the CSEs. It's written down as air-insulated switchgear. I may be wrong, but I think I've picked up in the documentation that that is now hybrid insulated switchgear.
Again, so I don't know whether you picked any of that up, but that sort of detail depends on the tender. It could be air insulated, or it could be what's called a hybrid system. Sorry. So there may be some confusion. Are you talking about the cable ceiling end? That's air insulated. The substation could be air insulated or could be hybrid.
Yes, okay. Certainly 3A is down as, which is a substation.
That's the substation,
yes. I think that's down as air insulated under point E there. If it's to be both, I suppose the works ought to be termed so that it can be both.
So that would seem to be right, and we'll have a look at that.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you. I'm grateful for that.
Right, then, moving on to the Schedule 3 requirements. The first item to look at is requirement 1.1, and the first question was whether the CEMP was adequately defined. We've already touched on this. I don't know if anyone has any additional points that they want to make.
If I can float a point on this, the CMP includes things like the written scheme of investigation. And I think that what we have throughout that, through the written scheme of investigation and the CMP, is consultation rather than agreement. So that it may be that consultation takes place, but that agreement isn't actually achieved on this. I think we just need to think out what's appropriate here and whether, in fact, a separate requirement on archaeological work is necessary in order to agree on method statements as the archaeology proceeds.
Yes, sir. There are two or three points on this. First point, as I've already stated, because the term construction environmental management plan is now going to appear in the list in Article 45, the whole definition of CEMP and construction environmental management plan will have to be lifted out and go into Article 2. It can't remain in Schedule 3 because those terms only relate to Schedule 3, and therefore, for the purposes of Article 45, we need to know what the CEMP is. The definition at the moment it seems to be slightly split. We have in paragraph 1.1 the definition of CEMP, but then, as you will have seen in paragraph 5.2, we have a list of other plans and strategies, and it may be appropriate, we need to think about this, that the definition makes it clear that the CMP includes all of those other strategies and that that is in one place. Now, third point is that one of those is the archaeological written scheme of investigation, and it was our intention that the CEMP and the various plans and strategies that form part of it would have been in effect approved through this process, which is why they could be certified, and would not be thereafter approved by the relevant planning authority. That's exactly the point that Mr. Riley was referring to earlier. He doesn't want it certified. He wants the CEMP and the plans under the CEMP to be then taken back for approval to the authority. National Grid would, just like that process dealt with now. Now, so in that context, if the CEMP and its various plan strategies and so on are certified, then that fixes them. But you will notice in requirement 5.4 we have the tail piece, which says the plans, schemes, strategy referred to in subparagraph 2 must be implemented as approved unless otherwise agreed with the relevant planning authority. Now, the intention here, and you'll see in 5.1 as well, all the construction works must be carried out in general accordance with the CMP, unless otherwise agreed by the local planning authority. Now, I think a number of these requirements will need to be amended because of the things we've already discussed, but the intention is that the CEMP and its plans are approved through this process, subject to any tailpiece which allows things to be done in a different way if the authority approve that. That's in sharp distinction to the requirement six plans and plans which appear in other requirements, which are all plans that are to be approved by the relevant planning authority. So the soil management plan, the drainage plan, pollution incident plan, and so on. And some of the other plans that appear in other requirements. Now, I think because of a number of the other things we've been talking about, we're going to need to have another look at this and try to rationalise the way in which these requirements are working and the definitions are set out. But that is the intention.
Yes, okay. I think that's that encompasses my concerns, really, which focus on a proper process of approval rather than simply consultation and then being established without proper agreement on the content.
Yes, sir. So that there's no misunderstanding, it is our intention with the CEMP and its plans that it's in effect approved by you and the Secretary of State. And that is done. That is why it is certified, because it is certified as the plans. This is what Mr. Riley for the Joint Councils is not completely content with. He wants the authorities to approve those plans. National Grid has produced those plans. They're here, they're available for anyone to comment on, and wants this process to approve those plans. And it's because of that that they then get certified.
Okay, then I think probably there is a point there that needs to be worked out. Who does the approving there?
Yes.
I think we have to be very clear on the direction we're heading with that.
Yes, so that's why, because I thought I might not have made myself clear, that's why I sort of repeated the point, and I apologise for repeating the point, just so that you understood what the intention was.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Right. We'll be coming back to CEMP shortly. Mr. Riley.
Sorry to stop you in your tracks. I think Mr. Humphreys might have taken the wrong emphasis from what I said a few moments ago. There are two distinct points. One is that the joint councils aren't happy with the CEMP as it stands. They've made their representations to National Grid. We're awaiting a revised version, as I understand it. If we can get to a position where both sides are agreed on the contents of the CEMP before the end of the examination, then there would be no need to submit a further version for approval. There's a separate point about certification, and that was a point about loss of future flexibility. And we made that point not just for our benefit, but very generously for the benefit of the applicant as well. And Mr. Humphreys doesn't quite seem to have taken that on board.
I don't know, was Mr. Humphreys' point was that at least minor alterations would be covered by the tailpiece attached to the requirement? Or is that...
We've not given that a great deal of thought at present, but I think we need to understand how that would work if the CEMP is actually part of the DCO. Sorry to linger on this point. I know Tess Bond wants to say a few words about archaeology.
Sorry, I'm aware that we could pick up on this further in the historic environment issue specific hearing, but just to clarify the point, Mr. Riley makes it clear that in relation to our approach for the CEMP and the document, but in addition to that, what's just been picked up on in relation to the approval of the detailed method statements for the written schemes of investigation, I'm under the impression that those detailed written schemes of investigation can't be submitted until later into the process. In the outline WSI, it outlines that these further detailed schemes will at some point be submitted. The Joint Council's concern is that we would prefer to see that formalised in a requirement. The outline WSI, I think in National Grid's response to the Joint Council's response to written questions, signposts us to paragraph 1.18 of the WSI, Our concern in relation to that section is it provides no formal procedure of how those detailed method statements would be approved. It doesn't benefit from the discharge of requirements schedule in the DCO, which clearly sets out timescales involved, who needs to approve the WSI. So I think it's that sort of detail that we need, and that's why we are seeking to have the detailed WSI set out in a separate requirement.
Yes, I mean, I'm cognizant of that, and it forms an important part of the agenda for the historic environment hearing. I think it's been published now, the agenda. So I think it's probably more productive to take that up in detail once we get on to that issue, specific hearing, unless Mr. Humphreys has anything further to say on that.
No, sir. I mean, that sounds perfectly sensible. I think the one point I will just touch upon, and it may be obvious, but I'll make it anyway, is that the reason why we are seeking to have the CEMP and those constituent plans approved through this process is that those are the plans that, to a very great extent, secure the mitigation which is set out in the environmental statement. And insofar as that is not secured, but is left open for something that has to be submitted to and approved at a later date, then the mitigation will not have been secured through the development consent order. The points just made were, if I may say so, very helpful points about the way, for example, the written scheme of investigation and any sub-plans under that may need to be approved. And that's the sort of dialogue that it's really important that the parties have to try and move forward these plans to make sure that they are in an acceptable form, that they can be hopefully signed off at the end of the process. So we will continue that dialogue, but I hope I've explained why we have the particular objective in mind that we do have in mind.
Right, continuing with the agenda, the next item was whether start-up and close-down activities and the word commence are appropriately defined. Mr. Riley, the Council's content with those definitions.
Madam, the Joint Council's, I think it's fair to say, understand the rationale behind having start-up and shut-down activities. We feel the definition as it stands is somewhat conversational in style, and there's a lack of precision as to what may or may not take place. Just to take one example, paragraph G refers to low-key maintenance of plant and machinery. With no hammering or banging, we'd simply prefer there to be no operation of plant and machinery, as an example of how this wording could be made tighter. I think Mr. Goodchild could offer some useful perspectives on the implementation of this sort of drafting, and I'd like to hand over to him now.
Thank you. I to emphasise a point I made right at the start of the meeting this morning, this is the sort of thing where, through our experience of the implementation of the Hinkley Point C DCO, it's absolutely critical that we are clear within this sort of definition so that we understand and can liaise and work with members of the community to work out whether activity is actually permitted or whether it is something that shouldn't be taking place. Just to give one example, in relation to the, it's not quite in this area, but in relation to the use of reversing beepers on the Hinkley Point C site, I personally get 5 or 6 emails each week about this particular point because it related the wording that EDF used in their in relation to their strategy referred to plant and machinery mainly used on the construction site. So to a member of the public, that means a vehicle reversing on the main site. To EDF, it means one that resides totally on the site and doesn't go backwards and forwards. So lorries delivering aggregate to the site use reversing beepers, and therefore neighbours complain to us as the local planning authority about that sort of issue. So from our perspective, having, with all due respect to National Grid, activities where it means one thing to one person and one thing to another, means that we're going for a considerable period of time be in constant dialogue with residents about activities which are taking place and whether they're causing disturbance, and the local authority is going to have to spend time working with residents and indeed National Grid to come to the conclusion about whether it's expedient or not to take some form of action. So this grey area that's created by this type of wording is not helpful to anybody in the long run. So from our perspective, we would really like this to be pinned down so that everybody can understand exactly what can take place and what can't. If a person arrives on site, collects the keys to their tractor or piece of construction equipment and then drives to the place where they're digging a hole, is that start up and shut down? I suspect if we asked everybody in the room, they'd probably come up with a different answer to that question. That is exactly the sort of thing that I would prefer, or the joint councils would prefer, to be taken out of the debate. If it needs to be one thing or it needs to be the other, I'm very keen, as you can probably understand, to avoid the grey area.
Mr. Humphreys, can we achieve greater clarity in this definition?
Madam, we're more than happy to discuss the detail of it. The drafting was based on the concept in the Thames Tideway Tunnel document called the Code of Construction Practice, which it wasn't exactly the same as the CEMP in this inquiry, but it was a document that contained a lot of explanation and mitigation in relation to the way in which the project was to be constructed. The concept is one that, as I understand it, is not in dispute, which is that outside the core hours for construction, it's necessary for some other things to happen. Staff arrive on site before they start work. You know, they need to change from their home clothes into their overalls, work clothes, those sorts of things. They may need to check their vehicles. They may need to do other things of that sort. And so what we were trying to do, and we'll continue to try and do with the joint councils, is define, you know, in a sensible way, without being overly prescriptive about it, the sort of activities which relate to, you know, people arriving at the site in preparation for work, and distinguish that from them actually carrying out the construction. And this relates, the definition obviously is in paragraph one of requirement one, but it relates to the construction hours requirement, which is requirement 7.3d. Which says the following operations may take place outside the core working hours referred to in subparagraph one: start-up and close-down activities up to 1 hour either side of the core working hours. And as I say, the intention is to just identify, you know, those things that workers do before they start work on site, and also do after they finished work on site. Either day, and as I say, we're more than happy to discuss that with the authorities.
I think that would be helpful, particularly in the relation to those specific points that you've made. Yes, Mr. Bamsey.
If I might, and it may be something the parishes wish to comment on as well, I think one of the particular concerns we have is because of the notion of the compounds we have, and what is the site? What is the site? Because quite conceivably, the compounds are a place of gathering, a place of activity before dispersal to the wider development across the scheme. I think, therefore, it's really important. I think I'm also mindful of the length of time those compounds will be in operation during this scheme as a whole. So being clear on this, totally support what Mr. Goodchild says, very important for communities of Bishop and Compton Bishop as an example to make sure we get this very clear, because I think they need to understand what to expect by way of control in terms of activity those early hours and towards the close of the day as well. Thank you.
Did you want to add anything, Mr. Parker? Would you mind just saying, for the record, just repeat
yes.
your name?
Sue Hayes, Chair of Badgerith Parish Council. This is a particular concern for the communities, 1 hour before and after the core hours. Looking at volume 5.15 of the ES, it says this will include, but not be limited to, deliveries, movement to the place of work, unloading, maintenance, and general preparation works. We don't know what that means. We don't know what that entails. But not only that, it also includes the lighting, the noise, any dust, and general traffic entering the site. The bell mouth at Tarnock is very close to dwellings. And it travels behind the houses in Tarnock to the large compound. They can then also then travel further down the line, down the Hall Road, to the ceiling end compound and the undergrounding works. This could be undertaken at 6 o'clock in the morning, 7 days a week. And we do feel that that is unreasonable. And at close down, it could be 8 o'clock at night and continuing in the evening, in the summertime when the nights are light, and therefore we feel that there should be some restriction, and particularly in a 7 day a week activity. Thank you.
Thank you.
Richard Parker, Compton Bishop Parish Council. If I can just add one more thing. The jointing work also is deemed to go on in the night outside those core hours, and that will be a significant impact on the residents. Thank you.
All right. I don't know if the applicant wants to respond or you just leave it as the matter that you've indicated you'll be looking again at that.
Yes, I mean, to give some reassurance, the definition of start-up and close-down in the requirements talks about arrival and departure of the workforce and staff at the site. I don't think it's intended that there were going to be, you know, deliveries and vehicles of that sort. It's really an issue of the, you know, the workforce being able to arrive at the site and prepare themselves for work. But let's not prolong this. We'll obviously take this away and look at it.
Thank you. Mr. Riley.
Thank you. Not wanting to jump the gun, but we were going to talk about commencement as well in this
yes.
item. We have something to say, if now's the right time to
yes,
say.
Yes, please do say that.
The Joint Councils welcome the deletion of devegetation from the definition of commence. The importance of the definition of commence, as I think we all appreciate, is that it relates to works that can be undertaken before particular requirements are discharged. The Joint Councils are still concerned that there are some works within the definition of commence which could be carried out without requirements being discharged. And one example which is in the statement of common ground on the DCO is the compound at Tarnock, which on the current drafting could go ahead without requirements being discharged, and the parish councils have just quite rightly flagged that particular location as a hotspot, if you like, which flagged me to highlight that to you as an illustration of why we think erection of contractors' work compounds and erection of site offices should come out of that definition as well.
Can I just ask Mr. Humphreys, he did say just a moment ago that it won't involve deliveries. Is that correct? Because the wording in volume 5.15 says this will include but not be limited to deliveries.
Right.
Yes, the... The most up-to-date document that you have is, or that we have, is the latest version of the development consent order, which has some of the latest amendments in red, and the definition of start-up and close-down activities is in red. It's a recent addition. Insofar as deliveries may be in the CTMP under start-up and start and close-down, that will have to be amended and removed. So what I am telling you is now correct. So things have moved on, in other words.
And did you want to add anything in connection with Mr. Riley's point on, again, on comments that was? For example, that was in relation to the removal of the erection of contractors' work compound from the exclusion.
Yes, madam. I mean, there are various things that we would want to do and have the ability to do early, and the definition of commence, you know, identifies what those things are. You know, this is not unusual. Those types of activities. It's not working or working in the contractor's compound. It is simply, you know, setting that up. As soon as we actually started to commence material operations, i.e. we actually started to carry out the development, then that would fall within the definition of commence. But, you know, there are various early things we would want to do, which, you know, of the type setting up there, erection of site offices, fencing, and things like that, which we don't think should be included in commence.
Thank you, madam. From our perspective, or the Joint Council's perspective, the construction of the compound, we believe that, for example, in requirement 6.1c and D, the pollution incident control plan and project environmental management plan ought to be in place before the compound is constructed. That's a sort of... Yeah, lighting scheme, for example. We feel that sort of information should be to hand and should be approved before such a large piece of kit goes in.
Thank you. Right, if we move on, requirement 1.3, that's in relation to the inclusion of tailpieces, which is allowing scope for changes pursuant to other requirements. the question on the agenda is whether this achieves what is intended and is sufficient to legitimise the use of those tailpieces in other requirements. Mr. Humphreys, do you want to explain to me why that...
Yes, Madam. Sorry, once again, I was just making a note. We're talking now about in accordance with design drawings.
It's requirement 1.3.
1.3, yes. Oh, yes. Madam, yes. The obviously this is not the tailpiece itself. Those are through all the other requirements. This is the restriction on the tailpiece to make it clear that it's something that's unlikely to give rise to materially new or materially different environmental effects from those. From those assessed. I mean, one of the problems, one of the challenges with development consent orders as a new procedure as opposed to planning permission is nationally significant infrastructure is very often very large projects, obviously, and because they're very large and often engineering projects, when brought for consent, they are often at a relatively early stage of design. The 2008 Act process makes it fairly difficult for us to build in flexibility, which for a very large project may be entirely appropriate and may be something, as Mr. Riley indicated earlier in a different context, may be actually something that is desired by both the applicant and the planning authority, some better way of environmentally mitigating something or some better way of solving a particular development design solution. What I suppose practitioners have tried to do is introduce these tailpieces, which started, as you know, in relation to planning permissions, and there have been various cases on this, including a case called Mid-Counties, which was a few years ago. The important point, however, is that any change to what is permitted through the consenting process shouldn't create some, you know, new environmental effect that ought to have been assessed and has not been assessed. And so what we've tried to do here is include the tailpieces which say, look, we can do it in a different way if the local planning authority say that we can, but then restrict in effect what the local planning authority can do by saying, well, look, they can't allow something if it would allow a materially new or materially different environmental effect. Now, we think that is an appropriate compromise, and you know, not to have something like this in there, you know, could give rise to real problems for promoters, and also mean that local authorities and promoters aren't able to, you know, aren't able to take advantages of better ways of doing things because we're restricted to what was in the in a plan or a strategy. So, Madam, that's we think this is perfectly justified and doesn't offend any wider principle of law.
Mr. Riley, are the Joint Councils content with that provision?
We understand the reasoning behind it. We've obviously seen something very similar on another DCO that we're acquainted with in the region. I think we'd just like to reserve our position slightly on the wording until we've conferred amongst ourselves, and we'll talk to National Grid on that. But I think the principle is one that's established.
Acceptable. Thank you. Right, if we move on now, requirement two, and the agenda point is the necessity for and reasonableness of a commencement period of 8 years. Mr. Riley, I understand you're seeking a limit, the usual limit, 5-year limit, not 8 years.
That's correct, and we touched upon this.
We did touch it in relation to compulsory acquisition. Mr. Humphreys, in relation to the actual commencement of the development as opposed to the compulsory acquisition point, is there anything you want to add or any further justification you want to provide for that extended period?
Madam, I think you understand our sensitivity about this because this is a form of development which is, in a sense, required because of other developments coming forward. What we're going to do is take this away and look at whether we think we could work with a shorter period than 8 years. It involves us having to, obviously, in effect, look at various different scenarios under which, you know, things could be delayed and outside our control. What we want to avoid more than anything else is a delay to our being able to construct this project, which is in effect outside our control, for such a period that then we're not able to commence the development at all, meaning that we then have to come back and get another order and go through the process again. Now, as I say, we will go away and we will try and look at this and sort of look at the different scenarios. I'm not promising that that will mean that we come back with a different figure, but it may do.
All right, thank you. Right, moving on, requirement 3.2 is the next one that we have in on the agenda, and that's, I believe, something we may have touched on earlier as well, which is the reference to, in general, accordance with the design drawings. And whether design drawings also should include landscape mitigation plans and trees and hedges to be removed plans.
Madam, it is important to us that we maintain in this place the words "in general accordance with." The design drawings are not intended to be the equivalent of a full planning permission. We have asked for consent for an overhead line within certain limits of deviation, both horizontal and vertical, and we want the ability to construct the line and indeed the substations within any of those limits of deviation. What we've set out in the design drawings, and this is why the design drawings, Madam, as your colleague pointed out earlier, have legends that say this is illustrative or this is indicative. What we have done is set out a representation at the moment of what we think would be the heights of pylons and, again, indicatively what we think a substation would look like in terms of its types of equipment. Obviously, we haven't carried out the detailed surveys yet. All that would have to be done in the future when constructing, and nor have we commissioned the particular bits of equipment that would go into the substations. What we were trying to do by producing the design drawings was giving people a broad understanding of that it will broadly be like this. It will not be precisely like this. And if we were to be, if there was an attempt to tie us exactly to the design drawings, then we would have to, in effect, withdraw the design drawings and say, no, we can't be tied to those. We cannot be committed to precisely those drawings. Those are indicative drawings of broadly what it is likely to be like. And we've been very, very careful in the environmental statement to make it absolutely clear that we've assessed the development within the limits of deviation. We have not simply assessed what the indicative designs are, and that at a very early stage when I was advising on the environmental statement, I made it absolutely clear that that was what had to be done to maintain that flexibility. So in this location, there's another location where we may be able to take general accordance out or general out, but in this location, it absolutely has to be there.
I think, Mr. Riley, you don't consider that to be necessary or reasonable, is that?
Thank you for that, madam. One of the themes for the joint councils today and throughout the process has been one of improving certainty in the application for themselves and for their communities. The ideal position, a very reasonable position for the joint councils, would be to see drawings which development would proceed in accordance with. We are at two removes from that certainty, it seems. First of all, we don't have drawings which are definitive, they're indicative, for lack of a better word. And secondly, National Grid are asking to develop in general accordance with broad drawings. There's a considerable amount of grey around the definition. I think Mr. Bamsey would also like to add to that.
Thank you. It strikes me that, and I was quite taken by the comment that if the Grid were needing to confirm they do in accordance, they withdraw their design plans, which seems quite a fundamental point to make at this stage in a long-running scheme that's been developed. So I'm surprised by that. But I can't help but think that a great many people are rather assuming that what has been applied for will be developed, not least of which the communities that are up and down the scheme length. And whether you be in Badgeworth or whether you be in Compton Bishop or elsewhere, I'm absolutely certain that communities have been very mindful of the plans prepared before them by Grid, and therefore I'm sure would very much want the plans to be implemented unless agreed otherwise. Thank you.
Well, madam, therein precisely lies, of course, the problem. Lack of understanding that we will develop what we have applied for. What we have applied for is a 400 kV line within limits of deviation, both horizontal and vertical. If we were tied absolutely to the design drawings, we wouldn't be able to deviate horizontally or vertically. What we have said and made clear is we think it will be, in broad terms, like we have shown in the design drawings. But we want to maintain the flexibility to move within those limits of deviation. When I said about withdrawing the plans, I don't mean we withdraw them in that they no longer are indicative of what we're going to do, but we withdraw them in terms of a requirement that says we will be in accordance or in general accordance. We would just simply say, look, here are our limits of deviation. Here is where the line will go. We will build it within this, and this is what a line looks like. And all of those plans which the joint councils point to that people say they have relied on all say on the side, this is illustrative and indicative. So insofar as they have relied on plans that make it clear that they are illustrative. Now, actually, there is a very, very high degree of certainty as to what is likely to happen. It's what is shown within our works plans. The environmental statement is absolutely clear, and clear to anyone that's bothered to read it, that it assesses the design within those limits, anywhere within those limits. What we've done is go further than that and say, look, we think it's going to be like this and we'll be generally in accordance with this, but we simply can't, on a 57 kilometre line, absolutely confirm that every tower will be at exactly the height shown on those sections. Just can't do that, madam.
So it would, as I understand it, would it be in accordance with those design drawings, except to the extent that you're allowed to make alterations in accordance with those limits of deviation?
In effect, yes. I mean, we can't go outside the limits of deviation. The works are only authorised within those limits of deviation. That's what the early articles say. And that's why the articles at the beginning make it very clear that we are authorised to carry out development subject to Schedule 3, which includes the reference to generally in accordance with those plans, also makes it clear, as we discussed earlier, that the development must be constructed and installed on the lines and situation shown on the work plans and in general accordance with the levels shown on the sections. The limits of deviation, Article 5, makes it clear how far we can move laterally and how far we can move vertically. And in effect, the design drawings show a sort of, if you like, a central case. Look, if we go right down the middle in a generic design, it would look like this. We expect it to be broadly like that, but it could deviate upwards and it could deviate to either side. That's what we've applied for.
Could I just ask if you could also address the second part of the agenda point, and that was whether the design drawings should include the landscape mitigation plans and the trees and hedges to be removed plans?
Madam, we did think about that, and I'm just going to check I've Yes, those landscape drawings, I think, madam, we felt could go in Schedule 2, which is with all the other plans that we have to that are listed there, and yes, whether or not Article 3 is the right place to do it, or whether it's actually the landscaping plan. But yes, it is our intention that those are plans that we would be in general accordance with.
Thank you, that's helpful. Anything else the joint councils want to add on that point?
Just a few observations. Mr. Humphreys just said that a number of the design drawings had some wording to the effect that they were illustrative or indicative on them. I'm just looking at one here, so it may not be the best example, but the wording says that all dimensions are typical and may be adjusted to suit manufacturer's equipment, but there's nothing more than that to suggest that this is indicative or illustrative.
I can't, it depends which one you're looking at.
So you can see the dilemma we may have in working out which ones are vaguely definitive and which ones may not be. There are two points as well around the in general accordance point. Mr. Humphreys has talked, I think, at length about the where, if you like, where a piece of equipment may go within the limits of deviation. But there's also a point about the what's actually going to be built. So Mr. Humphreys has talked about the in general accordance of the location of, for example, a substation or a contractor's compound. But there's still an issue that hasn't been addressed about how the design, the actual built form, may differ from what's illustratively shown on the plan. There's also a mismatch, I think, between the degree of flexibility, as the applicant may put it, or uncertainty, as the joint councils may have it, around what's being delivered and where, on the one hand, and the applicant's desire to lock down the mitigation through the CEMP and other related documents through the certification process. One can be changed, the other may not be, or not easily. I'm not sure, I'm looking to my left, if Mr. Goodchild or Mr. Bamsey wish to add to that.
Just a simple point, really. I mean, the word, or the phrase design drawings, is not defined. So I think from my perspective, and I'm sure my colleagues would think the same as the joint councils in relation to their enforcement responsibilities, would like it to be as clear as possible whether the development is being undertaken in accordance with the limits of deviation, or whether it's in general accordance with what's shown within the limits of deviation, because I can understand and I fully appreciate the fact that the environmental statement has been framed around the limits of deviation and that's been assessed. It's in general accordance with that in terms of the envelope goes wider from my perspective, and it goes wider and into another grey area, I'm afraid. So it would be helpful if the applicant could reassess this point, if they require some certainty themselves around the design drawings and what is or isn't approved, then please set that out so that we understand, and that everybody in the room and the communities affected can understand what is to be built, or what the envelope is to be built within, and then we can move forward and understand and appreciate what's likely to take place.
Thank you. Mr. Parker.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I might be out of order here, so please shut me up if I am. Excuse me. When I came in, I had a different view of what was going to happen here today, and I've been quite surprised to hear words like, from National Grid, we don't know, or the gate may not be wide enough, or things are very difficult to judge. And now we come on some vagueness about the plans. We have to go to the people. They're expecting what has been said to them to be what is going to happen. We've got a deviation of maybe up to 8 years before anything happens, and then a long period of work which has been extended already, and we don't even know what things are going to look like or where they're going to be. I might be overemphasising that, but that would be the perception of the people I'm going to have to speak to on Friday at an open meeting, and I fear my life. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for those points. It might be appropriate now if we just take a short 10-minute break, and we'll resume at 4:05.